It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WABE. Great to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Well, early this morning, the Senate, by the narrowest of margins, defeated the so-called skinny repeal of the Affordable Care Act proposed by Republican leaders. So it's Groundhog Day. Senate Republicans are still trying to put together a health care bill. And that's where we start another political breakfast. Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson are back. Both are political strategists. Brian is a Republican who served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron is a Democrat who was National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Good to be back, Dennis.
Happy Friday.
Okay, so skinny repeal was all about just getting something passed by the Senate and over to the House. And in fact, that's what Senator John McCain was objecting to when he voted no. And Brian, Georgia's two Republican senators, Johnny Isaacson and David Perdue, have both in the past argued against that kind of lawmaking, the approach of let's just throw something up against the wall, rush it through, and get it to the House.
Both can be right. In this case, what passes the Senate doesn't go from there to the president's desk. It's going to go back to the House for further negotiations.
But they've talked about regular order, committee hearings. They've railed against the way the Democrats passed Obamacare.
Of course, regular order has become next to impossible in today's polarized debate because either side can completely stop anything unless you sort of bend the rules and don't have regular order. That's a reflection of our political environment as much as anything. We've still got to go back to the House for negotiations. There's still a long road to go, and we need to keep sight of that.
But in terms of what this will mean, the uncertainty that it has provoked here in Georgia, particularly in the rural areas where rural hospitals are closing, is there a political price to be paid for that kind of uncertainty by Republicans?
I don't think that there is a political price to be paid based upon legislative process. I think people don't react to that on a day-to-day basis. What they will react to is the policy that comes out of this. They will react if we don't get something passed when we promise we're going to repeal it and we've promised that what we replace it with will be better, that it will cost less and expand your choices. So we've made some pretty big promises. We'll be judged on those. We'll be judged on our inability to pass something. And then we'll be judged on the outcome of that. How does that impact the pocketbooks of those blue-collar Americans, particularly, who perhaps got on the exchange and got insurance for the first time and then lost it or no longer got a subsidy that they had under Obamacare but voted for Donald Trump? I'm going to be watching what that group does as far as how they react to what comes out of the end of this process. If something comes out of this process, there's still a very good chance that they're unable to get something past the finish line because there's so much dissension and so much fragmentation within the Republican caucus.
The thing that we got to point out here is that Donald Trump ran on the repeal and replace promise during his campaign. And we've talked about how brilliant his campaign was. And he promised the American people, particularly his base and these blue collar workers that Brian are referring to. But the challenge is this, that here we are 6 months into his administration. And the reason you can't get anything passed is twofold. One, you have a president who is unhinged, who will say one thing on Monday and then turn around and say something totally different on Tuesday, and is not working as a team player with the Senate leadership. Then you have a weakened Senate majority leader, and Mitch McConnell, who can't even go to members of his own party and make them feel comfortable about voting on a health care bill that clearly may get them beat in 2 to 4 years back in their districts. And so Democrats, we've got to go beyond just locking down and saying that we won't vote for it. We've got to come back with a viable compromise.
On that subject, Theron, this week on Morning Edition, we spoke with Georgia Democratic Congressman David Scott, who's a member of the group called the New Democrat Coalition, a group of fairly moderate Democrats. They put out a plan of their own, which they're hoping to get some moderate Republicans to join them in pushing forward. This, though, contains some elements that actually sound like something the GOP leadership is putting forward, like the stripped-down provisions. You could buy just catastrophic health insurance, something like Ted Cruz is talking about. So even among Democrats, can you get unanimity about what you would put forward? If you're saying, let us in at the table, can Democrats even get together about what their proposal would be to Republicans?
ultimately, I think Democrats will get together to meet Republicans halfway to do something about this important issue around health care.
But you know the leadership's not going to go for stripped-down proposals, the Ted Cruz model.
But here's the problem. If you would eliminate the politics between Ted Cruz, who was defeated by President Trump and who many in the Senate kind of despise because, let's face it, Ted Cruz likes to do a lot of his own things. But the one thing I want to compliment David Scott on and these new Democratic leaders, which are people who are a part of the old Blue Dog caucus, is to really do what I've been preaching on this show for weeks now, and that is don't just be opposed to the Republicans' inability to put forth a bill that folks can vote on. Come back with an actual compromise. Now, ultimately, what this new group is going to have to do, they're going to have a really key and concise message to more of the progressive liberal wing of our party. And we have a few of those members here in Georgia who are Democrats who are probably not going to be as comfortable as the Congressman David Scott. I think that they at least have come forward with a viable solution that hopefully the Republican leadership will pay attention to.
Brian, on the Republican side, speaking of internal dynamics, I'm not sure there's a linkage here, but maybe subconsciously there could be. President Trump is telling Republicans to get in line, in the Senate especially. At the same time, he's attacking Jeff Sessions. Now, if you think about it for a moment, when you think about Senate Republicans, who have they had a longer relationship with, Donald Trump or Jeff Sessions? If he wants votes on health care, is he smart to be going after somebody that they have so much respect for, even though the two issues might not be linked on the surface?
You have seen one Senate leader after another, chairman, people in leadership, et cetera, who have stood by Donald Trump through thick and thin, who have said this week, lay off, stop talking about Jeff Sessions. And you're seeing also some of the deep conservative wing of the party and spokespeople on radio and TV coming
Breitbart
out saying—
Breitbart and talk show hosts and all kinds of
Tucker
people.
Tucker Carlson and even Rush Limbaugh is like, whoa, lay off. And these are people who, as Tucker Carlson said, and I agree with him on this, that Jeff Sessions represents the viewpoints of a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump.
But does that cost him on health care, though, do you think? Is there any linkage between the two?
I think the fact that Jeff Sessions is what Donald Trump is talking about and not health care, that is your linkage. And this is something I have been pounding the drum on all week. Donald Trump has the unique ability to drive a news cycle in a way that very few presidents have ever understood. He really gets how to make the media talk about a certain thing or to divert their attention from a certain thing. He's brilliant at it. Why isn't he using that power of the bully pulpit to talk about health care and why Republicans are pushing a plan that's going to be better for middle America?
Well, he did certainly distract things this week when he issued that tweet talking about a ban on transgender people serving in any capacity in the military. Theron, Georgia is a military state. It also, especially in some of those military areas, is a deeply conservative state. So does the president's tweet and the subsequent confusion affect military areas of this state?
Absolutely, Dennis. And at a time where you already have transgender Americans right now currently serving in our military, let's start there. So this whole ban is just so discriminatory in a lot of different ways. My viewpoint is this. If an American can pass all the necessary tests and the requirements to serve and protect his or her country, then that individual should be allowed to do so. To Brian's point, at a time where we need to pass a health care bill to ensure that Americans have affordable health care, this president is tweeting out about banning transgender Americans from serving in the military. What Donald Trump has run into is that leadership in the military is basically saying, until you actually tell us, until you come forward with this ban, we are going to continue to operate.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Correct. And so I think that now our president is now going into some very deep and troubled waters by interfering with Americans' ability to serve and protect this country.
Brian, coming back to Georgia's two Republican senators, so far as we speak, they've been quite quiet about this, and yet they represent a state which is one of the leading military states in the country. Won't they at some point have to come out with something fairly definitive one way or the other?
If it goes through the Senate Armed Services Committee, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And as Senator McCain said, we can't have executive order by tweet. We're going to have this flushed out to really understand exactly what the implications are, such as, does this include people who are already serving in uniform, people who are perhaps in a foreign theater at this moment? That is what the tweet implies, that it's not just future enrollment in the military, it's people who are there now. That raises serious legal questions that are going to have to be worked out. So there's a lot to determine moving forward. We don't have enough information. We don't know what his full intent is. This needs to be flushed out. But well, I will say this. To announce this in a tweet without greater context, without greater detail, without a policy prepared is really irresponsible.
And the chief of the VA didn't even know about it. And this goes directly to Senator Isaacson because he is the chair of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Now, obviously, this deals with people who are veterans. They're no longer active in the military. And yet when your VA administrator doesn't know about it, and presumably the chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee in the Senate, Johnny Isaacson, didn't know about it, what does that say?
It says that Donald Trump operates in a silo, and this has been seen over and over and over again. It's not just people who want to be his friends in the Senate and House. It's people who work for him in the White House who go out with a message determined by the group. They give the message. They take the bullets that come with it. And then the next day, the president contradicts them and says something totally different, pulls the rug out from under them. This is a constant problem of him speaking off the cuff, shooting from the hip. The danger of what it means for him as the executive of this country is that it's almost a Chicken Little moment. People are going to just tune out what he says. They'll watch it for entertainment value, perhaps, or for the shock value. But people are going to quit thinking that his word means something if he goes out and says things that he can't deliver over and over and over again.
Does this increase pressure on someone like Senator Isaacson, who is known to try to wield his influence behind the scenes, to actually, because he's chair of the VA committee, come out and say something one way or the other publicly?
You know, one thing that Perdue and Isaacson have to walk a tightrope on here politically, and I agree with you, if Johnny does anything, it'll be behind the scenes as someone who gets us to a more amenable compromise on this, is that probably many or significant majorities of Republicans in Georgia are a little uneasy about the T in LGBT. We've come a long way when it comes to gay and lesbian issues as far as acceptance in the South. The transgender is much more misunderstood or not understood, and there's a lot more resistance to it. So coming out and being completely against it might be something that they have to be a little wary about.
Got just a couple of minutes here. Let's move quickly to the race for governor of Georgia among the Democrats. Theron, we'll start with you. It's Stacey versus Stacey, Evans versus Abrams, both leading figures in the state house. Of course, Stacey Abrams, former House Minority Leader. This week, Congressman John Lewis came out with an endorsement and endorsed Stacey Abrams. Now, endorsements are a dime a dozen these days. People trot them out all the time. But if there's one endorsement that would mean something in the Democratic Party, it's that of John Lewis. How does this affect the race, do you think?
This is a big endorsement for Stacey Abrams. I mean, she's had an ongoing relationship with Congressman Lewis. She's been planning to run for governor for a very long time. And so I think over that time, serving as minority leader and being sort of shoulder to shoulder with Congressman Lewis, you just look at the Women's March that we had here earlier in the year, she just really had a good relationship with him. Has really been fostering that the relationship. How it affects the race, I think it'll do three things. I think it will give her some more legitimacy in the African-American community. I think it definitely will help her with her national fundraising and local fundraising. We saw that from the John Ossoff campaign, how the early endorsement for Congressman Lewis helped his race. And thirdly, listen, I think it's a person that you can use to come out and sort of say, you know, on down the road in your campaign, that I'm endorsing her because of X, Y, and Z, and I think it helps her. Now, the good news for Evans is this. It's not really a shocker to a lot of people, Dennis, because John Lewis endorsing Stacey Abrams, there are just so many parallels there from them personally mm-hmm. and professionally, one from Mississippi, the other one from Alabama. But I think what Evans has got to do is just move on from this and try to really continue to talk about the issues. But look, is it a big endorsement from the Abrams campaign? Absolutely. But also, it's going to be very important to see how much Congressman Lewis will actually do in the race. Will he be as involved in her race as he was in John Ossoff's race?
There's a chance here that Lewis is going to endorse Abrams, and at some juncture, after having gotten a lot of pressure, he changes it over to Evans.
That's not fair, you're going back in history now.
We've seen that happen before.
We have been jabless thus far.
For those who don't remember, very quickly, Congressman Lewis endorsed Hillary Clinton back in 2008, shortly before he changed his mind and endorsed then-Senator Barack Obama.
Yeah. So there's still hope for Evans out there. So she just needs to hang tight, be nice, and see what happens. There are very few Democratic endorsements in the state of Georgia that mean anything in a Democratic primary. Other than Jimmy Carter, it would probably be John Lewis that could pull some weight. And certainly it made national news when he switched his endorsement from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama, because he is a special case. He's not just a politician. He is someone who made his name really doing something else. And, you know, marching over bridges, not marching up the steps of the Capitol. That's what makes him different and makes him special. So I think it's a huge win for Abrams, but I think it's also important that Abrams has been getting support of one union after another. You're talking about a biracial or multiracial coalition in those unions, which is going to be critical. There is no way around it. In a Democrat primary, there's going to be a majority African-American electorate, that we've got a one white candidate and one African-American candidate. And that's going to play a role. But one thing that has intrigued me watching on the sidelines as a Republican is that both candidates are showing a diverse coalition. There's a lot of African-Americans supporting Evans and a lot of white people supporting Abrams. It's really interesting. I think it shows it's a sign of the times here in Georgia.
Is it a sign of the times, though, that Republicans need to watch? Because if they can translate that biracial coalition and attract moderate Republicans in a general election, white moderate Republicans, is that something Republicans need to be aware of?
Well, that is exactly what they thought John Ossoff was going to do, and it didn't happen. You know, in recent election cycles, Democrats statewide in Georgia have gotten about 20% of the white vote, an abysmal number. Now, the problem for Republicans is we've come to rely on that 80% of the white vote and can't win without it. So if they can chisel away at it, and they don't even have to be that good to get to 25% or 30%. I mean, they don't have to be geniuses to pull it, but they haven't been able to. If they ever can, we're going to have a very competitive state.
What's very interesting is that when Brian Robinson starts giving credit to labor unions, Dennis, we need to watch out. I mean, this is unparalleled for a Republican in this state to compliment a diverse labor union. I mean, that has been a transformational experience for me today on this show.
We're talking about a Democratic primary, not a general election, where I don't think it matters at all.
But the fact is this. These two women are both very qualified to run for office. I think that, yes, the African-American vote is going to be paramount in the Democratic primary. But I still believe the person who can put together the best bipartisan, biracial, by geographical coalition will be better prepared to go on to face whatever Republican emerges from the Republican side in November of 2018.
We're all going to wait on pins and needles to see, you know, which of these two gets to go on to lose to the Republican in November of 2018.
But the one thing that I think Brian has got to be aware of is that we know that this state is becoming less and less white. It's becoming more and more brown. And at a time where yes, John Ossoff did lose, but it's not an exact replica of the state. But I think that Democrats are going to benefit from these demographic shifts that we're seeing. And if either one of the Stacys run a very moderate to conservative general election in November of next year, I do think they can have an appeal to these moderate Republican women.
Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican who served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for Governor Nathan Deal. Brian Robinson is a Republican who served as Deputy Chief of Staff and Communications Director for Governor Nathan Deal. Theron Johnson is a Democrat who was National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Gentlemen, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, and we'll see you real soon.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Dennis.